mortals should think mortal thoughts. It is hubristic, it's arrogant to try to think about God, let alone try to become like God.
Hello, and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times. This is Harry.
And this is Ali. Today we have Passion in Ancient Philosophy and Religion. The main speaker is Rowan Williams, most famously the former Archbishop of Canterbury, but also a writer and poet.
And our host today is Professor Angie Hobbs. She's a professor of public understanding of philosophy at the University of Sheffield and on the advisory board for Plato's Academy Centre. So, what is this talk about?
Well, Rowan has recently published a book called Passions of the Soul. And with Angie, they dissect how passion can be balanced with reason and influence our approach both to religion and also to each other.
Sounds very interesting. And this recording is from our latest Hay Festival. So, Angie, take it away.
It's a real pleasure to be here and obviously fantastic to be discussing with Rowan Williams. We're going to start by discussing his fantastic new book, Passions of the Soul, about the Eastern Christian tradition in Egypt and Syria and in monastic communities there. Rowan, do you want to start by just telling us a little bit about what the book's about?
Well, thank you. The book started as some talks for nuns, which is one way of killing the market straight away, I think. But they recorded the talks and sent them around to other convents and monasteries. And a few years later, somebody said, "Oh, I've been listening to your talks about the passions." I thought, "Pardon?" And I realised they'd been circulating in Samizdat, as it were, for a few years. So I thought maybe I should draw them all together and tidy them up a bit and make a book. So that's how it started. But it represents an interest that goes back actually a very long time in the way in which the early Christian world tries to think about the mind. About the mind in relation to instinct, intuition, emotion. The way in which mind in that intellectual context means a lot more than we think it means. And I was fascinated, tantalized for many years by the way in which the ideal for many early Christians, as for many pre-Christian philosophers, the ideal is often presented as freedom from passion. And that, on the surface of it, is a very unattractive proposal for most moderns. What did that mean? What does it mean? Can we make better sense of it? Has it got anything to say? And really, the book is an attempt to answer that, distilling some literature from early Christian monasticism from about 400 to about 800 of the Christian era, and looking at the ways in which the passions of the soul are identified and understood, and what is really meant by this idea of freedom from passion. So that's what's going on there.
Okay, so we're going to dig both into passion and freedom. You're going to get a lot for your 35 minutes. So can we dig a bit more into this notion of passion? So on the one hand, you said, yeah, the goal is apatheia, and yet the book is not actually about extirpating the passions, that these texts are about regulating them, moderating them. So I read this and I thought, oh, there seems to be a tension here. Are we meant to be aiming for freedom from passion, or are we meant to be moderating it? And look, not all passion is bad, they're saying. There's some role for anger. And of course, there's the passion of Christ. So can we dig a bit more into what they mean by passion and how it's compatible with freedom from passion?
I think at the very heart of this is the idea that pathos in Greek, passion, really means something like being at the mercy of circumstances, external and internal. You can talk about the passion of Christ because that's the point at which Christ is at the mercy of circumstances, being killed by people. But inside us, our emotional, instinctive, and intellectual life is always, to some extent, at the mercy of circumstances, more than we realize. Part of what it is to grow up spiritually and morally is to get a rather keener sense of what it means to be at the mercy of circumstances and how we prevent ourselves from just being reactive all the time. How do we become active rather than reactive? I think that's the bottom line. So being apathetikos, being free from passion, is not having no feelings. It's not being at the mercy of them, knowing what to do with them, knowing how they work, and in that sense, becoming freer to act, not by suppressing, or as you say, extirpating the passions, but understanding them, educating ourselves about how we work.
And I find this really interesting because it resonates with so many ideas in ancient Greek philosophy, both classical and Hellenistic. In the Stoicism, for instance, you've got the goal, and in fact, they go further to extirpate the passions, but then they define passions in quite an extreme way. And it turns out you are actually still able and indeed encouraged to have all sorts of emotions of affection and so on. So I was really intrigued by this, but I also kept coming back to this notion of freedom because somebody might say, well, come on, surely being free is just being able to do whatever I want, whenever I want, nobody stopping me, nobody interfering me. I just follow my whims. How you're talking about all sorts of restraint and moderation. How is this freedom? So let's dig into different notions of freedom here.
Absolutely. Because I think what a classical or early Christian philosopher might have said in response to that is, if that's your idea of freedom, then in fact, you are always reacting. You're always saying, oh, I like that. Oh, I want that. Or, yes, let's go there. Oh, yes. Grab, grab, grab.
Yeah.
It's what the Buddhists call the monkey mind. You know, you're leaping around from branch to branch, grabbing what you can put your hands on. And you can learn a lot about how this works from setting it alongside how the Buddhist tradition thinks about some very similar issues around craving, but that's another story. But there's a real overlap there. So the essence of unfreedom, really, is just always to be reacting. So if freedom is not like that, what is it? I think for most of the people we're talking about, pre-Christian and Christian, the heart of it is something like the freedom to be what we actually are, the freedom to act out our humanity for what it is, not to be victims of illusions about what it is to be a human being, the illusion of total passivity, the illusion of total arbitrary liberty, somehow settling down, being a body in time and how that works. That's freedom, coming to terms with that.
Would you say the freedom to be what you are or become what you are? There's a lot about that this is never completed, there's a journey which you're never going to complete.
That's right. And again, back to this idea of the passage of time being important. To understand our humanity, we understand it's a time-taking thing and we're always growing and learning. And part of the discipline that some of these early Christian writers, like their Platonic forebears and Stoic forebears, were talking about is something to do with the processes of learning ourselves, learning how we work, which takes time.
And the role of reason in all this. We've got to bring in the role of reason. So it's very sad, I know this, I ought to get a life, but there is a passage in Plato's dialogue, the Gorgias, and it's 462 to 468. As I said, it's really sad. Where he makes a distinction which I kept thinking about when I was reading Passions of the Soul. There's a distinction which Socrates makes between doing what you feel like doing on the spur of the moment, on a whim, dokeimoi in the Greek, to do what you feel like, it seems a good idea to me to do this. And that is distinguished from boulomai, which is to do with choice, which is the result of a reasoned, rational reflection. And again throughout his dialogues, Plato says, if you want to be free, you will act on the result of rational, free, informed, reflective choice, for which, of course, you need access to accurate and free and truthful information. One of the reasons Plato's so unhappy about sophistry and fake news, it deprives us of even the chance to be free if we're not given access. I was so excited, I squeaked there. But anyway, this is exciting stuff. This really matters. And that passage in the Gorgias, which is then developed in Plato's Republic, where going back to what Warren was saying, if you just keep reacting, if you're just going away on the kind of the impulse of the moment, buying the next thing, just keep reacting to the next advert, you will remain a prisoner in the cave. You will, this search for what is later called negative freedom, the freedom from external constraints and anybody interfering with what you think you want to do, that which Isaiah Berlin later calls negative freedom or negative liberty, that is actually going to keep you imprisoned in the cave, as opposed to the opposite, which Isaiah Berlin will later call positive freedom, positive liberty, which is you have agency. You are making your own choices as a result of reasoned rational reflection. So this link between reason and freedom, which of course then becomes key in the Enlightenment, I just saw that again and again.
Yes, yes. And it's a reminder, of course, that reason in this context doesn't act as a kind of impersonal, super absolute, detached activity. It's a matter of the discipline of, to put it in a nutshell, the discipline of the real. You put aside your particular preoccupations, you try to attend to what's in front of you and pick up the connections, the resonances. And that's where the Stoic language, actually, of attunement, the tonos, the fine-tuning
of the Stoic language.
Exactly, that really comes in, because the reasonable mind is not one that can marshal arguments in a sort of way. It's much more the mind which works in resonance with how things are.
Yes.
So that's why, in the same early Christian tradition, you have the insistence that contemplation, good religious word, actually begins in, first of all, what's called practical contemplation, which is learning how to lead a consistent life, in which reflection is part of it, moves into a contemplation of how the world works. You get a better sense of how things hang together around you. You see the connections, and moves eventually into what we would now normally call something more like meditative or spiritual contemplation. But it's a continuum in which reason plays exactly that part of tuning in.
Yeah.
Realism.
Exactly. And again, another Greek distinction between the word sophos, meaning wise, from which, of course, we get philosophy, love of wisdom. That's why we're all here at this festival. And what they call deinos or deinotes, cleverness, being clever, 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 which may have no, you can win the argument, but you may have no connection with reality at all. So we were already edging towards intellectual virtues involved in this search for freedom from reactive passion. And let's broaden it out into the virtues more generally and other virtues of character. So where are the virtues in all this? Because again and again, you write in this so eloquently about how this spiritual journey should not be some self-gratifying, self-indulgent sort of ego trip. You have a wonderful phrase. There's lots of wonderful phrases. There's stuffing the world. Sorry, stuff it. Or you do it. You do it. You'll do it better.
Was it stuffing the world into the rucksack of the ego?
Exactly. Exactly. It's absolutely brilliant. So where are the virtues in all this? And then we will edge on into current debates about virtue signaling. And
yes, I suppose one of the things I was trying to do in the book and in the original talks was to connect this kind of negative analysis of what goes wrong or what disturbs the inner life with the Beatitudes in the Gospels, blessed are the poor in spirit and so forth. Not virtues in quite the conventional sense, but they are, if you like, the other side of the coin. If this is what a life looks like that is distorted, turned inwards, navel-gazing and self-preoccupied, well, turn the sock inside out, and what's the pattern? You see a set of habits of the mind and the heart which have to do with attention, skepticism about oneself and one's own agenda, a sort of life-giving skepticism, which I think is a good habit. A lack of defensiveness and protectiveness in one's relation with others. And also a real sense, and this is very strong, of course, in the Beatitudes, a real sense that the deprivation of other human beings is your issue. It's your problem. You are losing out in the loss and the suffering of others. It's your business. And all of that comes from understanding better those reactive habits, those defensive habits, and turning them around. So virtue in that context becomes a matter of, again, of realism, of a habit of self-questioning. Good Socratic.
Yes.
Sensible there. And also this, not exactly what you might call compassion in the ordinary sense, but something almost a bit deeper, the instinctual recognition that the suffering of, I don't know, a child in Gaza, a soldier in Ukraine, an indigenous person in the Amazon basin, is not something that happens over there. It is something which is part of a network of action and suffering in which you are involved and which affects you, like it or not. Come to terms with that.
Yes, so rather than performative virtues, it's a quiet, attentive, listening kind of virtue.
And we were talking a little bit earlier about the failure to meet Iris Murdoch in our areas.
Oh, yes.
Iris Murdoch's focus on
yes.
attention, which she draws from Simone Weil. You know, that's all part of this same story, isn't it?
Yes, when learn from my mistake, and particularly anybody younger in the crowd, Iris Murdoch wrote to me when I was in the 1980s when I was doing my PhD and said, let's start a dialogue about philosophic dialogue. I know I'm an extrovert, but extroverts can be shy. I was too shy even to properly respond. I never did. And then she developed dementia and I never could. Just say yes. Don't worry about whether you're good enough or whether you're up to it. Just say yes. So this is really interesting. So this distinction between virtue and performative virtue clearly gets us to a really key and contested current debate about virtue signaling. Now, I have maybe unfashionable views in that I think that normally virtue, except unless real attempts are being made to deceive or be hypocritical, I'm normally not totally against virtue signaling. So to start with, I think the term is used far too often to dismiss genuine attempts to be more virtuous. It's so lazy and cynical, isn't it, to say, oh, they're just virtue signaling, when somebody might be genuinely trying to be virtuous. It lets you off the hook, doesn't it, if you just assume everybody else is a hypocrite and just being performative. So that's lazy, that's cynical. What about actual virtue signaling? Well, the signal might be to yourself. You might be trying to exhort and encourage yourself. I do a lot on Marcus Aurelius's meditations, which are often accused of performative virtue signaling, but we don't even know he's intending anybody else to read his meditations. He's trying to encourage and console himself at the end of each day. It seems to me that even if you do need a bit of external encouragement in your path towards virtue, maybe that's not ideal. Maybe it would be better to be entirely pure, but it's better than vice signaling, which seems to be very fashionable at the moment, and certainly amongst certain politicians. So, I mean, where do you stand on virtue signaling? And this, it's a very complicated issue, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Because virtue signaling is part of that family of vocabulary developed in the last couple of decades, essentially meant to lower our moral aspirations as yes. a society. That's what worries me, that something is being put into the water supply of our imagination here, which is to talk about ideals is somehow at best naff and at worst dishonest. Now, that's not a good place to land, because I think that we should be able to talk about ideals even when we are manifestly not living up to them, is important. Otherwise, speaking for myself, but I dare say for a few others, there would probably be nobody in any pulpits on Sundays. And as you say, to hold oneself accountable in a certain way, to say, well, this is actually what I think we ought to be moving towards. And to talk about it, even sometimes ineffectually or confusedly, does at least still hold us to something. Now, it connects with the old dictum, I can't remember whose it was originally, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue.
Yes.
Meaning that there are certain things which a lot of us are more or less instinctively rather ashamed about, and it doesn't hurt for us to be reminded that there's something against the grain in some kinds of ungenerosity. But the problem does come, and this is the performative stuff, isn't it? The problem comes when the expression of certain kinds of position becomes either a substitute for action or not much more than a tribal marker. Just assuring the people around you, well, I have the same values and standpoints as you do. And it doesn't really suggest any change. And the tribalism of our moral discourse at the moment is so marked that I worry a bit about that. I don't know what to do about it. I have no great solutions to the problem, but just a sense of the need, A, not to buy into what you call the lazy thinking that calls things virtue signaling, but equally not to buy into what can be the sentimentality of just going along with the echo chamber, keeping that self-questioning alive, that skepticism I mentioned.
Yeah, well, we need you. Yes,
come
we
back,
need
Socrates. All is forgiven. Yes.
So, okay. So we've already mentioned Socrates and Plato and the Stoics, but I want to kind of look at the links between these monastic traditions and ancient Greek philosophy a bit more closely, because they are really close.
Yes.
A lot of the writers that you write about, the Christian writers, are absolutely steeped, particularly in Platonism and the Neoplatonic tradition. And a really interesting debate is about the aspiration to become like God. So this gets, I mean, this starts actually way back in 5th century Greece, BCE Greece. There was always a debate about whether you should follow the lyric poet Pindar, who says very firmly, mortals should think mortal thoughts. It is hubristic, it's arrogant to try to think about God, let alone try to become like God. And that tradition continues really throughout the West. You get it in, nobody reads Alexander Pope anymore. I wish they did. I had to at school and I'm very pleased. But
me too.
I should have written this down. I haven't, but know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. So you've got that, just you're a human. Remember, you're a human. Don't get above yourself. But then along come Plato, I mean, following the Pythagoreans and the Orphic traditions, and then and Aristotle following him, saying, no, where is the moral ambition in that? We should try to become as much like God as possible. Of course, remembering we're human, we're mortal, we're flawed, we're not going to fully succeed, but we should see our lives as this continuous attempt to progress towards that. And that debate is just really rich in this. So do you want to say a bit more about how the writers in this work pick that up?
Because, of course, they pick up on both those traditions in a way. There's a strong sense that it's important to know what we are as human beings and to understand our place within a world of finite and material realities, and not to suppose that we're a sort of second best for angels, not quite belonging anywhere. But at the same time, the Platonic and Neoplatonic ideals of theosis, deification, are deeply embedded in early Christian language. But the way in which this is then turned around is something like this. Two elements are at work here. One is taken very much from the Platonic tradition. We are like God in our capacity precisely for freedom. For reflective freedom. We're not actually purely animal or mechanical. We're not purely reactive. We have the liberty to make a difference to the world we're in, to shape our identities. And in that sense, to that extent, not being restricted by all that, we are godlike in the broadest sense. But then the second dimension that comes in is, of course, what comes from the specifically Christian input. And that is, we become godlike by becoming Christlike. That is, we grow into something of the compassion, the mercy, and the intimacy with God that Jesus exhibits. Jesus, as a human being, who is also in Christian theology the carrier of the divine, Jesus, if you like, shows us how these ideals belong together. We can be dependent, responsive, receptive, and still be godlike, because we're receiving a love that we then send back. And that sense of a love and liberty that can really be exercised even within our limited humanity. That's a powerful element in all this, isn't it?
It is. And mentioning Jesus there brings us back to this notion of where the body is in all this, which actually gets us back to the beginning of our debate. Yeah. So there's a really interesting debate towards the end of this book. And I knew a little bit about Oregon, a little bit. And he's very into the Neoplatonists. And in his view, becoming like God is really very taken from Plato's Timaeus. And it's trying to emulate the rational harmonic proportions of the Logos. So it's all very mathematical, very musical. It's all about the Logos. And then there was somebody who I'd love you to say more about, because I'm ashamed to say I knew very little about Gregory of Nyssa, but as a really interesting, rich, serious thinker, saying, no, we've got to get the body back in here and let's get Jesus and the body of Jesus back in.
Gregory of Nyssa, late 4th century, a bishop in what's now Turkey, and somebody who, like his family and his friends, had been educated in Athens in philosophy and rhetoric. And he wrote a very important book. There's a wonderful new edition of the text just come out, a book called, I suppose the best translation is, On the Human Constitution, which is a long meditation on human nature, on the relation between mind and body and soul and body, on the way in which, as he says, the mind, or the intellect, the whole sort of mental process, is inseparable from the body. We think with and in our bodies. We think with our hands. We speak with our tongues. We make sense as a body. And so he says, you're not ever going to be able to find somewhere in the body where the mind lives, because it lives everywhere. It penetrates everything about the body. And he says explicitly at one point, the mind is not in a part of the human constitution. To be human is to be mindful in some sense or other. And that means our bodies are the carriers of intelligence. We can't understand the notion of a body without appealing to the notion of mind, because our bodies are what we make sense with. Equally, though, we can't understand a mind without the concept of a body. Because how on earth do minds learn and grow and change? Well, they see things, they sense things.
Yeah.
So he's very keen to say there's an absolute simultaneity between mind and body there. And he does indeed relate this to the way in which, in Christian theology, in the life of Jesus, the divine and the human and the mental and the physical are absolutely inseparable. They work together and you can't disentangle.
Yes. I must go and read more of Gregory of Nyssa, which is...
Everybody, I love learning.
So we've been talking so far mainly about the journey of an individual, the spiritual journey of an individual. But of course, a lot of these writers and a lot of this book is about the Christian community and how Christian communities should react to each other, to other Christian communities. You make a delicate comment at one point about your sorrow that the current Russian Orthodox Church seems to have lost its moorings, which is based in this debate. It has its traditions in this debate, but it seems to have lost its moorings. But you also talk about how Christian communities should relate to the state, the military, and so on. So can you say a little bit more about the importance of community?
All this teaching about the passions is grounded in community practice. These are monks trying to, and nuns as well, trying to live together peacefully, trying to live together with a sense of the difference of particular callings and particular pathways, not tyrannizing over others, not imposing models on others. It's a very strong aspect of teaching of the earliest monastic communities. So there's a strong strand there, simply within the religious community, of the purpose of all this being not just coexistence in the sense of tolerance, but an active appreciation of the diversity of a community, which is made possible when some of your own anxieties and obsessions have been, if you like, disciplined and trimmed back a bit by understanding how the passions work. But then with somebody like Gregory of Nyssa, you also move out into a much broader perspective on how this is a model for our human social living, how that sense of the deep appreciation for and respect for the image of God in the other works, how, and again Gregory writes about this at some length, how the presence of poverty and privation in a community ought to be a matter of your own anxiety and urgency, because it's, as I said earlier, it's your issue. So that's certainly going on in the background. It's the period when the church is just beginning to make terms with the Roman Empire, a very ambivalent and complex period where a church which had up to then been marginal, pacifist, communitarian, is suddenly projected into the middle of a militarized and hierarchical society, and is reacting in, as you might expect, rather confused and difficult ways, foreshadowing exactly the confusion and betrayal sometimes that one sees in the Russian church today, and I'd be perfectly prepared to be untactful about that subject. It's ironic, isn't it? The image on the front of this shows a 19th century Russian saint, Seraphim of Sarov, who was well known for making friends with wild animals in the forest. So that big lump on this side is a bear that St. Seraphim was very friendly with. And Seraphim, who was a hermit, a reformer, a teacher, is in some ways the absolute antithesis from the militarized, xenophobic, messianic nationalism that the Russian Orthodox Church now seems to be wedded to. And it's, yeah, for those of us who love that tradition, it's a bit of a heartbreak to see that church betraying its most life-giving central history. So there is a lot there that in fact challenges the tribalism, the nationalism, the corporate and individual selfishness that goes with it. And I think it's very important that you pick up this non-individual dimension here. We were talking a little bit earlier, before the event, about the work of David Brooks, the American journalist and commentator, writes for the New York Times. And he's written a couple of books on the importance of character and virtue. That's very helpful. But I remember when I read the first of these that I'd come across, thinking, this is terrific about individual self-understanding and growth. What I'd like to know more about is what a virtuous community and a virtuous institution look like. How do you embed a level of selflessness and non-defensiveness in corporate life, let alone public life?
My final thought here, and then I'll give the very final thought to Rowan. So, I mean, I'm an agnostic myself. I'm very interested in religion. I'm not an atheist, I'm an agnostic. I just don't know. I find it impossible to believe or not to believe. But I got so much out of this, because there was, whether or not you're a believer in Christianity, there is so much about the passions, about virtue, about freedom, about the enlarged self, as we were saying at the end, about how an enlarged sense of self might prevent us from the kind of self-indulgence, not just on a spiritual journey, but also on a philosophical journey. Because all of us here, we're all interested in philosophy, and there are also dangers in being self-gratifying and self-indulgent in your philosophical journey. So let's make that a journey where the enlarged self is on that journey, not just your private, oh gosh, I'm much wiser than I was before I came to Mad the Light Gets In. Though, of course you are. So just really, really rich. But the final word to Sawyer.
Oh, no. One of my great philosophical heroes is another friend of Iris Murdoch's, Mary Midgley.
Oh, yes. Happy.
And her wonderful book, The Myths We Live By, is really about how in contemporary Western society we have internalized, thoroughly internalized, a picture of what it is to be a human being and what it is to be a human race that is actually pretty toxic. It privileges unexamined desire, unexamined emotion. It privileges dominance and control. It privileges autonomy of a very unqualified kind. And if you look around, it doesn't look as if it's making a very good job of allowing us to be human in a humane sense. I think this, if anything, this is a book about challenging the myths we live by.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Thank you so much, Rowan Williams.
Thank you, Angie.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy for Our Times. We hope you enjoyed that talk. Did you enjoy it, Harry?
I enjoyed it very much.
I love hearing ancient Christian wisdom run into the midst, because I feel like it's often overlooked either by ancient philosophy or kind of more modern Christianity that's a little less mystical and probing.
And we always love to have Rowan Williams. It's really rare to have a sort of intellectual of his depth and nuance in public life. So we do enjoy having him.
I so agree. You should share your thoughts as well, if you want, with the email in our description.
And remember to check back in next week for another episode of the podcast. And if not, check out iai.tv for thousands more podcasts, videos, and articles about the world's leading thinkers on the biggest ideas of our time.
See you soon.
Bye.